Kristen. I have met Kristen recently, within the past year or so. She moved here from out of town, and I watched her immediately get involved in service and meetings and just like jumped right in there. And it was really awesome to see and really inspiring. And I know she works a great, solid program. So I'm excited to start my new year out right and hear her experience strength and hope. Here she is.
Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Kristen.
It's always a privilege to be able to speak at an AA function. My sobriety date is January 13th of 2006, and my sponsor is Kathy D. And let me tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I grew up, I'm from Newport Beach, California. So I was, I grew up in a really loving home. I have two wonderful parents, an older brother who's perfect, and he's still perfect. And just really a loving home. I got everything I ever needed and probably everything that I wanted, which led to a lot of entitlement issues later on. But there was nothing wrong about my childhood. I was very, very blessed. And just growing up in general. Now, if you would ask me what my family was like while I was drinking, I would tell you they were horrible monsters, and they hated me, and it was a terrible environment. And but that once I got sober and I was able to look back clearly, I was the problem in that dynamic. So life was wonderful up until the first day of sixth grade. Everything was great until my boyfriend of an entire summer, who we were very serious, broke up with me the last day of summer going into sixth grade. And I was really upset that I was, you know, I was going to make it through. But what happened was him and his twin brother and their little friend harassed me, like all of sixth grade, and made fun of me and picked on me. This is not why I'm an alcoholic, I'll explain that later, but my mentality was that my coping skills and all I could get from just that young age of sixth grade was when I was considered popular, nobody was mean to me, and then as soon as I wasn't cool, everyone was mean to me. So my little brain said that in order to survive life, I need to be cool no matter what. I gotta figure that out, I gotta fit in, I gotta have friends, I gotta date the right guy, I gotta do the right thing to get to a level where people aren't gonna make fun of me. So I started living in my head a lot. I spent a lot of energy thinking of how I was gonna get revenge on this guy and what I was gonna do as I got older. And my high school was 7th grade through 12th grade, which was really bizarre. But since I had this older brother, I was like, okay, when I get to 7th grade, I'm going to have the basketball team put these guys in lockers and trash cans. And you know, I was just planning their demise for the future. And none of that ever happened. Nothing I ever think about and spend time in my head ever happens. But I spent a lot of energy in there. So when I got to high school or 7th grade, I was going to make my move, and I was going to figure out how to be popular, but there were a couple problems. One, it took forever for me to go through puberty. I swear every other girl in my grade hit puberty except for me, and I still looked like I was, you know, fourth grader. And my very conservative mother only let me shop at Limited 2. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with that, but where I grew up, there was Wet Seal, which is where the cool girls shopped, and then there was Limited 2, which is where I had shopped. And I just remember I had like a pair of plaid pants that I wore a lot, like golfers would wear, which I feel like they kind of wear as a joke, but like that was like all I could wear. And so climbing the social ladder was not happening for a long time. And but fortunately, being in such a big environment, I was able to, you know, get away from the people that were tormenting me and kind of hide out for a little bit. So what I did was I would make friends with a group of people and then try to get in with, like, the next person in the social ladder and, like, climb up as best I could and then do whatever I could do to stay there. And my freshman year, second semester, I was, I had a new best friend, and her name is Marilyn, and she's, I'm still in touch with her today. She's actually been sober for a long time as well now. But we looked alike, we sounded alike, we took tests for each other, I mean, we're very similar, and I kind of thought she was pretty cool, and so I thought, since we looked the same, you know, I was also as equally cool. And what happened was, we went to a party, and she drank, and I didn't, because I was raised in this conservative Christian home, and I really thought that God would, you know, I'd go to hell if I drank, and so... that's because that's what I heard in church was like, if you think it, it's a sin. And I just, there was so much pressure to be perfect and I just couldn't do it. So I was trying really hard. And the next day, the two most popular girls in our grade called Marilyn and were like, hey, do you want to hang out? And I was like, well, why didn't they call me? Like, we're the same. We're the same person. The only difference is that she drank and I didn't. And so I said, you know, okay, that's it. That's the key. I need to drink. I need to fit in, and I'm going to need to drink. So I went to Marilyn's house one weekend, and there was a little party up the block at the pool, and I drank for the first time. And that thing that happens to make me different from my fellows happened. I drank, and I just immediately was like, I took off the limited two stuff, I put on one of her little skimpy dresses and high heels, and I put my hair down, and I went to this party, and I felt like I was the coolest thing. You know, I had arrived. And I just, this false reality just took over. And I mean, I could do no wrong, I was funny, I was cute, I was, you know, I don't know what anybody else thought, but this is all what I thought. And that's all I really cared about, you know, was what I thought of myself. So, after that experience, I mean, why would you not want to be like that all the time? Why would you not want to feel like that all the time? So, I started seeking out people that were drinking during the week and partying, and I would ditch school a lot and do all that kind of stuff. And what happened was my family life got really, really bad. My parents were at a loss on what to do. They were on the verge of getting a divorce because they couldn't, you know, one was like, give her another chance, it's a phase. The other was like, no, we got to like cut our losses. And we got the one kid, we did something right there. I don't know how we messed up on the other one, but like, let's just focus on the good one. And so that is just a mess. We're constantly fighting. My poor older brother, you know, he really took to the church. So where I heard fire and brimstone, he heard love and acceptance and grace. And his experience was just so different from mine that he, all his friends were in the church, and he led the Christian club at our school his junior and senior year. And I think one year he wore a Christian t-shirt every single day. And I just couldn't do that because so I felt like since I couldn't be him and I couldn't be perfect, the whole God thing and religion thing was too much for me. And so I just kind of turned on that and decided I was going to do this cool thing and figure out how to do this and do whatever it takes. And I became a really mean person. I started bullying people. I was a horrible person because I hated myself and I was so insecure and I was afraid people would find out how little I thought of myself. But I just kept blocking it out with drinking. And I remember one day my mom woke me up and she said, do you know what happened last night? I said no, because I never knew what happened last night. And she said, you know your dad's dad, your grandpa, was an alcoholic. And I said, yeah, I know. But he was a prisoner of war for 3.5 years, so I feel like he should drink if he wants to drink. I don't know. He did end up getting sober, actually, before I was even born. I never saw him drink. But anyways, when my dad was young, he would find my grandpa passed out, naked, placed, you know, in the house and have to get him up and get him to bed. So my mom was telling me this story that I'd heard before, and I was like, okay. And she said, your dad came down at 3 a.m. and saw you at 17 years old, passed out naked with your face in a quesadilla. And honestly, that is like the most horrific thing a father could see. That's not okay. But at the time, my reaction was, well, what was he doing up at 3 a.m? Yeah. I mean, if he had waited, I would have flamed it. I would have ate the quesadilla. I would have got dressed. I would have gone to bed. But it was like, I couldn't take responsibility. Like, it wasn't, nothing was my fault. There were things in life. I just was so gone from reality. And that was at 17 years old. So I ended up graduating high school, and I went off to college, and I didn't go very far because, I just went like 45 minutes away. And college, where in high school I was able to get by and get good grades and I didn't really have to work that hard, college was different. And I started failing out because you have to show up and they like want you to read intense books and do stuff. And I wasn't capable of doing that. I was a very non-functioning alcoholic, which I'm super grateful for, because had I been functioning, I probably wouldn't be sober today. I don't know how, you know, I mean, I just couldn't do anything. I got fired from every job I ever had because they wouldn't let me make my own schedules wherever I was. And then I started failing out of school. And I tried to juggle that and, like, hide from my parents and withdraw and, I like, from classes before I got the F or whatever. But, it just wasn't working out, and you could see that I was getting worse, and I was losing a lot of friends because of my drinking. My behavior was insane. And then I finally got a DUI, and I was 21, and my parents and my brother sat me down, and they said, you know, we think you have a drinking problem, and you have two options. You can go to rehab, or you can leave. And you have your car, it's in your name, it's paid in full, you can take that and live out of that. But we've taken you out of school, we've closed up your apartment, and we've changed the locks on our house, and you're not welcome here. And I thought, screw you guys, I'm good, like, I'm out, you know? And I start, this is the girl who can't hold a job, who's failing out of school, from Newport Beach, and I think I can go rough it on my own in my car. So as I'm walking to the car, because I basically gave them the middle finger, I started thinking about it, and I said, you know, I didn't really know what rehab was. I didn't know that they offered that for people with a drinking problem. I thought it was like a drug thing. So rehab, you know, you do yoga probably, you meditate, you just hang out for a little while. And I was so tired. I really felt that I did deserve a break. And I could. You know, so I turned around. I said, okay, I'll do the treatment thing. But only 30 days. Not doing any more than that. Because, you know, we get cured in 30 days. So they said, okay, deal, like anything, just like, let's get her locked up somewhere. So I said, but not until after New Year's. And they were like, no, you're going as soon as possible. This was in December of 2005. And I said, nope, I get New Year's. And my dad was like, no, they sent me to the Betty Ford Center in Palm Desert. He said, I will call Betty Ford myself. You're going in next week. Like, I don't care. We're not waiting for New Year's. So we waited for New Year's because I got my way. I don't know what I did. I have no memory of if that was a good time or not. But I did get my New Year's. And then I went in on the 12th of January. And the reason my sobriety date is 13th because I went in completely drunk at 7 in the morning on the 12th. So that could not be my sobriety date. I went to rehab under the guise of just getting the heat off. I had no idea what I was in store for. I had no idea about recovery, which is weird because honestly, when I was 16, I actually was court ordered to go to AA, and I went and I liked it. I would ditch school and go because it was so fun being around you guys. I really enjoyed it. I didn't realize at the time that it was because I could relate to everything you were saying, and I certainly wasn't ready to stop drinking, but I would go, and you guys were nice, and you were funny, and you told stories that I could relate to. But I didn't make the connection until I came around this time that I was actually one of you guys, which is why I felt so good being at the meetings with you. So in treatment, they gave me a big book, that $30,000 big book that Betty Fortune gives you. I thought I was just going to go and kind of like lose a little bit of weight and meditate, learn how to, learn how to drink like a lady, whatever that meant. I certainly had no intention of getting sober. That was just so far from I was 21 years old. So, I mean, I just had a lot of room there, I thought. And what happened was I read that book and it started talking about the alcoholic and the way we think and the way we react, and it had nothing to do with how much I drank or the consequences that happened when I drank, although a lot of those things were listed in that book, but it was more about my perception of reality and how I went through life and how I interacted with my peers. And I read things like The Jaywalker, which was like, I just sat there and was like, oh my god, that's so me, but with alcohol. Like, weird, but I never thought alcohol was my problem. I swear to God, if you had asked me before I got sober, if I thought drinking was my problem, even though I had a DUI, I was failing out of school, got fired from every job I ever had, alcohol was always the reason for it. I had no idea. I just thought God hated me, and I had a rain cloud over my head, and that was going to be the story of my life. So I read this book, and then, and the part where it talks about being the director and how, you know, you try to, like, force things on people, then we don't get that result, then you try to be nice, and we don't get that, you know, and that was me. That was how I interacted with everybody. Just really sick. And I remember closing the book, because I was in rehab, and I was in my room by myself, and I, like, put it on my bed, because I didn't want anyone to know I read it, because I knew I had a decision to make. I knew that I was whatever that book is talking about. And according to that book, if I don't do the things suggested, my options are not pretty. You know, jails, institution, and death, right? And I did think that I was gonna die at like 24, because I knew after I graduated college I couldn't have a job or anything, so I just thought I would like kinda like fizz out. And I wasn't upset about that. It was like, you know, I thought it might be cool. I don't know. So I started listening in the groups, and I started kind of sharing my experiences and reflecting on my drinking. And that was something that I am grateful for the treatment center, was they did make me like write down times when alcohol affected certain things, because I never saw it. I never saw it until somebody made me look at that. The denial was just, it's just amazing. It baffles me to this day how I never thought alcohol was my problem. And I remember my parents coming in with a police report for my DUI. And I don't have a memory of the DUI, but what I told my parents happened was I knew I was too intoxicated to drive, so I pulled over. And I must have parked in like a yellow curb zone, and the cops came and broke my back window to get in and arrested me. And I should have just kept driving, but I tried to do the safe thing and pull over. I just happened to be in a yellow zone. And the police report said what actually happened was I was in the middle of an intersection. My friend was in the car with me. We were both passed out. I had my left blinker on and my foot on the brake. When I was 16, I crashed my car like 6 separate times, totally sober, but like not putting my foot on the brake enough. I would just hit the person in front of me at a red light. So the fact that I could be completely intoxicated, passed out, and have my foot on the brake hard enough for however long I was there to not kill myself or somebody else is an absolute miracle. Like, I can't. And when my parents read me that report, I didn't know what to say. Like, I didn't have a lie. I didn't have an excuse. I mean, they took really good notes on exactly what happened. I just kind of was like, well, you know, I'm in treatment. So, hopefully that doesn't happen again. And we had to do a family group. That's fun. That's where you sit in a circle with a bunch of people, and you and your family sit across in the middle, and they tell you, you know, how disappointed they are in you, and all the things that you did that they really don't like, and you just kind of get to sit there. And I remember my brother telling me, you know, that one day, he had just gotten married, he said, one day I'm going to have kids, and they will never, ever know that they have an aunt. Not ever, if you can't say sober. I don't want you in my life. And at the time, I was like, dude, didn't you hear, like, relapse is, like, a thing that happens a lot? You know, like, I have this sickness the whole time, like, mine, it turns out I have this disease, you know, cut me a little slack. But he wasn't having that, because, see, I ruined his childhood. I ruined his relationship with my parents. While he was doing things and making accomplishments and coming home and being like, look at the award I won, or look at, I'm captain of this team. My parents were saying, that's great, Alec, but we got to go get Kristen out of jail. That's great, Alec, but Kristen's having a problem. So that was my brother's life. He did all these wonderful things, accomplished so much stuff, and instead of my parents giving him the attention he deserved, they were too busy trying to save my life. So I get it. I get why he was so angry. Not only that, he was a senior. Remember, this is the guy with the, like, Christian shirts. And he was also an athlete, and he would go into the locker rooms and hear the guys in his grade talking about what his little sister did last weekend. Yeah, not cool. Not good. So when he graduated high school, he took off for college, and he went as far away as he thought he could go, and he never came back. He didn't want to visit. He didn't want to come back. And I don't blame him. I don't blame him at all. My mom was just so happy that I was, like, not, you know, in jail, that she sat there and said, nothing's wrong. Everything, I forgive you. You know, she's just the sweetest lady. And my dad just kind of sat there. Like, I've been through this before. I can't believe my luck. I had it growing up, and now I have it as an adult. You know, I got totally screwed here. And that treatment center, the Vancouver Center, it's only a 28-day thing. They decided I was sicker than most, and I needed to continue treatment at another facility because 28 days was not enough for me. So I got sent to a place in Long Beach, California, and I really didn't want to go because I had met a couple guys in treatment. And they were going to go to this aftercare in Palm Desert. And so I was, like, all about going to aftercare. Yeah, I'll go to aftercare. I'm going to go right there. And they knew what I was doing. And they were like, no, you're not. We're sending you over here. And I complained, and I made a fuss of everything, and I wrote my journal that my counselor was jealous that I was cuter than her. I was still very sick, clearly. And so eventually they were like, fine, you don't have to go to Long Beach. We're now sending you to Utah.
Wow.
And I was like, no, Long Beach. So much better. Better idea. So they sent me to Long Beach. And that treatment center is kind of where I think my life was saved. They said, you have to get a sponsor if you want to go on PASS. Who doesn't want to go on PASS when you're in treatment? So I found a sponsor. I wasn't picky about it. I just said, hey, I have to come home with a sponsor tonight, or I can't go get my nails done on the weekend. So we signed this piece of paper to sponsor me. And she said yes. And I would meet with her every week, and we would start working the steps. And I decided that I would give Alcoholics Anonymous a year of my life. It had already been, I was counting, so it had already been like 2 months. So I had 10 months left, and I thought, I will do everything and anything y'all tell me to do. Get a sponsor, I'll work the steps, I'll be as honest as I possibly can, I'll make AA my life, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. I'm gonna do it, and if it doesn't work and I'm miserable, then I'm gonna go drink, and, you know, I know what happens to someone like me if I drink, but if what you have here doesn't work, then, you know, I'm going to go out and blaze glory. And what happened was, I was in treatment for 60 more days, and then they sent me to a sober living, and they said I had to get a job, which was terrifying because I never really had a job. You know, I mean, I had them, but then I lost them. So they made me get a job selling shoes, which is what Al Bundy did when in Maryland. So while all my friends were graduating from college and starting these careers, I was selling shoes. And but it was like the best thing that could happen to me. I mean, I learned how to show up for something on time, and I took pride in the fact that I held a job for a second, you know, and that my boss thought I was a good employee. And there were times where I would call my sponsor in the morning and be like, I can't go to work today. And she'd be like, well, why don't you just get dressed and call me after that. Call her dressed. I still can't go. Just, I have anxiety, not feeling it. I need to call in sick. She's like, why don't you go down there and just pull in the parking lot. Call me when you get there. Okay. So I'm going in. I'm already here. This is stupid. I'm just going to go to work. You know, I was like a baby. I needed somebody to tell me every little thing. And as I started working the steps with the sponsor, the promises started happening. Just totally unbeknownst to me. Things were happening. I had friends, like real friends. Mm-hmm. My family, you know, they're so wonderful. They already forgave me. They were like, you know, very involved. My mom and I were talking all the time. I mean, that relationship was being healed. I was working. I felt like I had, I don't know, a purpose, a plan. And at 6 months of sobriety, my life was better than it had been since I could ever remember. I mean, there was no way I was going to trade this deal in. I was no longer giving you guys a year. It was where it worked. I drank the Kool-Aid. I was in 100%. You know, I mean, the book says if you're like this, here's what you do. And it's crazy because a lot of us go, but I have another idea. You know, and it's like, no, just here's what you do. But yeah, we're like, let me just try a couple things here. And it's just baffling. I mean, it's just amazing how ridiculous we are. But when we get back to it and we cease fighting, things just, life is so much easier. I mean, things just go. And I had that experience at 6 months sober of just being like, this is amazing. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I was so grateful, not really to be an alcoholic, because I was 22, and that wasn't like super exciting, but just the fact that there was a solution. You know, there was something, and I felt so good about this. And another little thing about me is I did think that I was supposed to be rich and famous somehow. I wasn't sure, like, how that was going to work. I just, you know, I just knew that was, like, in the cards for me. And that was going to be my purpose. I was going to be rich and famous and show everybody, you know, whoever everybody was. I mean, nobody really cared about me as much as I did. But what happened was I got my first sponsee, and her name was Kelly, and she was in college at the local college in Long Beach, and she started calling me and started going to meetings, and I went to her college, and we did step one together. And she got out, she was like, bye, like went back to the dorm, and I remember sitting there, and I felt so full. That hole that I had been trying to fill my whole life was completely full. It was overflowing. And I felt like if my only purpose in life was to plant a seed in that girl so that she could maybe have a taste of what I have, I could die. I mean, I was done. If that's my purpose, right. I felt so fulfilled. I felt so one with God. I mean, it was a miraculous experience. And I just remember my whole body being like, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm finally in the right place at the right time doing the right thing. And Kelly didn't end up staying sober, and I have no idea where she is today. But I know that there is a seed planted for her that if she ever thought she had a problem and wanted to do something about it, she knew where to go and what to do. And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and working the 12th step. It gave me a purpose to where I didn't think I needed to be rich and famous anymore. I can just be an alcoholic, and I am. So, let's see. Going down the line, stayed very active in AA. That was always my first thing, you know, because I was told that as soon as you put something else above Alcoholics Anonymous and your sobriety, you're going to lose it. So I didn't want to do that, right? I didn't want to lose all this good stuff that I got from being sober. So I didn't. AA was my life. I went to meetings. I had commitments. I sponsored people. I had a sponsor. I worked the steps. I worked the steps again. I lived life, and it was fantastic. And I made amends after 1 year of sobriety to my family. And my brother took a while to come around, but I am officially Aunt Kiki. And my niece and nephew know who I am. And they love me. They love my husband more than me. But they love me. I met my husband when I was in treatment. But like they say, when you do that, one or both of you are going to not stay sober, and unfortunately for him, he did not. So now I have more time than him, which is fine with me. So anyway, and that was the gentleman that read How It Works. That's and we have a really good life together, and the AA is the center of it. We got married in 2014 in April, and in November of 2013, I got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And I thought, this is bullshit. I mean, because it's another, you know, disease that's progressive with no cure, and I really thought God should even out, you know, who gets what here, because now I have two of these things. And it wasn't fair. And I forgot that finding out I was an alcoholic was actually, that I was grateful for that. It was the best thing that's ever happened to me. Completely forgot about that. And went into a lot of self-pity about having this. You know, told my husband, because we weren't married yet, and said, you can leave. I get it. He was like, you're ridiculous. Like, getting married. And I had to work on that. My conception of God had changed. Thank you. Because it was too limited for somebody with MS now. And when I first got sober and decided I was going to be a good person and I was going to kind of follow the rules, I did have this illusion that like life was just going to be, you know, like awesome and downhill. And that, you know, unfortunately, at least in my case, is not the case. And things happen. And it's still life. And I'm not spared from anything. But I had like 7 years sober when I got diagnosed with that. And I can't even imagine if I wasn't sober, what would happen when I'm out there getting diagnosed with something like that. I mean, I just would have, I would have no chance to... You know, I wouldn't have a job with insurance to cover the medication. I wouldn't have the husband to support me. I wouldn't have the family. None of that. I wouldn't have any of that. And just recently, I got accepted to participate in a trial in Chicago to cure my MS, which is like brand new. Nobody says they can cure it, but this guy does. And I got accepted to do that. And I'll be doing that. This year, I'll get to go do that. And again, my life will change. And I'm so grateful that I'm sober, that I could research that stuff, that I could have the support of my family, that I have a job that has insurance that's going to cover this. And I can't tell you how fulfilled I am every day. Just knowing that I'm doing the right thing. I'm doing the next right thing. Not all the time, but as often as I consciously am aware that I need to do it. And as far as my sponsor goes, Kathy, she's amazing. And I had a little bit of an ego when I came here, and I was like, I have 10 years sober. I need to make sure my sponsor has more time than me, and you know, was really great. And I met Kathy at a meeting, and I heard her share, and hey, you ever experience being in Kathy's presence, she is like so zen. And I am not zen. I am not there yet. But she has, you know, what I want. So I asked her to sponsor me, and I found out she had less time than me. I was like, damn it. Like, I should be, right? You know, you're so zen, and I'm not even zen, and you have less time. Like, where did I go wrong, right? But she's teaching me how to be like that. She's helping me find this new conception of God that I need that's bigger than the one I had prior to this diagnosis. Because it wasn't enough, what I had. And she has this amazing relationship with a higher power. That's what I want. So I follow her. And I remember one day going and meeting with her and feeling sorry for myself that I had MS. Because sometimes out of the blue, I'll just say, this is not fair. I'm an alcoholic and I have MS, like two things. And she said, let's write down all the good things that MS has done for you. And I was like, oh, that's easy, nothing. That's not a thing. And then after like an hour, I had a whole page of stuff in ways that my life changed for the better. And I can't get that anywhere else. If I had gone to therapy and had a therapist try to say, well, Kristen, why don't you write that? I would have been like, screw you. Like, you don't know what it's like. But with Kathy, it was like, okay, you know, like, all right. Because I want what she has. So I need to, you know, basically do a 4-step on my MS and work through that. And it's a work in progress because that's exactly what I am. But it's so beautiful, and it's so much more graceful than it ever could have been had I not gotten sober. And my life, I'm blessed. Like, I wake up every day and I thank God because I'm blessed. I'm so blessed. And it's all because of this program. And it's because I came in here and I did what the book told me to do, and I followed direction. And, you know, I remember when I first read in the book that, you know, we cease fighting everyone and everything. That's in the book. And that's a problem for me. Because I fight everyone and everything just for no reason. That, you know, I would do that just, that was how I survived, was the I'll show you mentality. And so I was scared that coming here, I wouldn't be able to do that. You know, I wouldn't be able to stop fighting people. But I did. And I remember being in college and praying and saying, God, just let me be, move me to another city. Take me out so that I can be a nice person. And I don't have to have this false reputation that I've been trying to have. Just let me start over. And a week later, I got my DUI. It's not so funny. That was not how I was done. But that's what happened. And it worked. I transplanted into Long Beach, where I started my recovery. And now I'm here. And I'm continuing my recovery, and the AA here is fantastic. I'm very grateful to be a part of it, and thank you for watching.